And I was very lucky to have the beginning and ending of the conference represented by people from Kansas. That's, I felt, it was some significant amount of recognition to the hospitality we have had here in this area of Missouri as well as Kansas. So when I got this proposal from Craig Parker, I was so happy that finally, through some switching, we could have him here to end the conference. Craig B. Parker, since 1982, has been on the faculty at the Kansas State University in Manhattan. There he teaches music history, theory, and applied brass. Before that appointment, he was a trumpeter with the Long Beach Symphony, composed a brass quartet and many other Southern California organizations, and also as a sort of a fellow Southern Californian, I'm very glad that he's going to close the program, too. Dr. Parker has performed many of the solos of Herbert Clark, and I'm pretty sure that many of you are, I see Fred Williams there, nodding his head. And he has lectured on Clark at meetings of the American Musicological Society, College Music Society, International Trumpet Guild, and the Sonic Society for American Music. So to talk now about this famous and very, very good soloist of the American brass movement, I have here Dr. Craig B. Parker.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here today, and it's a little daunting to speak to an organization such as this on my first effort into discography after being basically a musicologist and biographer for years, especially knowing that Fred Williams, the world's expert in the field, is out in the audience. During the golden age of the professional concert band in America, roughly 1880 through 1930, each band featured at least one cornet soloist. Of the four dozen superstar cornetists profiled in Glenn Bridges' book, Pioneers in Brass, the virtually undisputed king of the cornetists was Herbert L. Clark, who was born in Woburn, Massachusetts, September 12, 1867, and died in Long Beach, California, January 30, 1945. In an interview published in the spring 67 issue of the Journal of Band Research, bandmaster Carl King, composer of Barnum and Bailey's favorites and over 100 other marches, declared that Herbert L. Clark was the greatest cornet soloist who ever lived. David Hickman, one of the top trumpeters and teachers of today, wrote that Herbert L. Clark is to the cornet what Paganini is to the violin and Liszt is to the piano. Harold Bachman, former director of Bachman's Million Dollar Band, the University of Chicago Band, and the University of Florida Band, stated, "I don't suppose there was any musician who was any more highly respected by his colleagues than Herbert L. Clark." Chauncey Weaver, writing Clark's obituary in the March 1945 International Musician, wrote, "When he arose to play his solo, the golden tones seemed to be unlimited in their solar flight. Who could refrain from cherishing the recollection of such an hour?" Before I go further into the biography, I'd like to give every one of you a chance to hear Clark play his most popular solo, The Bride of the Waves. Note the flying fingers in the coda, as well as the effortless high F at the end. Thank you. During his illustrious career, Clark was featured soloist and first chair cornetist with some of the major bands of his era, among them the Gilmore Band from 1892 to 98, Sousa's Band for a short time in 1893, then from 1898 to 1901, and 1904 to 1917. Clark played over 7,000 program solos plus encores during his career. He traveled nearly a million miles with bands led by Gilmore, Victor Herbert, Frederick Ennis, John Philip Sousa, and others, making 34 tours of the U.S. and Canada, 4 European tours, and 1 around the world tour. He also served short stints as a trumpeter with the New York Philharmonic and the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, but he left both of those jobs to go back with Sousa because Sousa paid so much more. Clark also conducted some of the most famous bands of his epoch, among them the American Band of Providence from 1902 to 1904. This band was later renamed Clark's Band of Providence during his tenure there. Sousa's band as assistant conductor from 1904 to 1914, the Anglo-Canadian Leather Company Band of Huntsville, Ontario from 1918 to 23, that was later renamed the Anglo-Canadian Concert Band, and the Long Beach, California Municipal Band from 1923 to 1943. Many of Clark's private pupils, which he managed to work in between these concert tours, became highly regarded performers and teachers throughout the U.S. and Canada. Among them was the great Mexican trumpeter Rafael Mendez. Clark's writings about music continue to be reprinted even today, while his 4 pedagogical method books are standards in every trumpet and cornet player's library. Clark wrote over 240 compositions and arrangements during his lifetime. These pieces have been recorded from the earliest days of the infancy up until the industry up until the present day. Although Clark's marches, overtures, and other works for band, his piano pieces, his sentimental songs have long since faded from their respective repertoires, Clark's compositions for the cornet continue to be played by students and by professionals. Clark was the son of William Horatio Clark, an organist-composer who's profiled in the first 4 editions of Grove's Dictionary. Herbert, like most of his American wind virtuoso compatriots, was self-taught as a composer, though. In fact, his father did not want him to be a professional musician, wanted him to be a businessman, but Clark figured that why work for $10 a month in a store when he could make that much per night playing the cornet? In addition to being regarded as the greatest cornet virtuoso of his era, if not of all time, Clark's original compositions, especially those, or his original cornet compositions, outshine those of virtually all of his compatriots. During his tenure with Sousa's band, almost every concert, except for those devoted exclusively to the music of Sousa, featured Clark playing one of his own original solos. Sousa also programmed some of Clark's band pieces, among them Plantation Songs and Dances, which Sousa's band played in a command performance for King Edward VII on December 1st, 1901, and that was reputedly the King's favorite number on that concert. Clark wrote over 50 solos, duets, and trios for cornet and band, most for his own use as a soloist. Most were published with band, orchestral, and piano accompaniments, and about 20 of these still remain in print in some form or other. His cornet works fall into 4 different categories: the polka, such as The Bride of the Waves, which usually has a dazzling triple tongue section. He also wrote waltzes, slow ballads, and theme and variation works, such as Carnival of Venice. Clark's successors as cornet soloist with Sousa's band continued to play Clark solos, which were then regarded as the paragons of the literature. Many of these Clark solos still remain on required repertoire lists for high school music festivals. These works remain popular with audiences today due to their tunefulness, rhythmic vitality, virtuosic display, and Clark's comparative mastery of harmonic and formal elements. Clark's recordings are voluminous. Since Sousa would not conduct recordings for almost all of his career, the task of conducting recordings of Sousa's band usually fell upon the assistant conductor of the band. In this capacity, Clark conducted approximately 1/3 of the over 1,100 recordings made by Sousa. His name was never listed on these recordings since Victor apparently wished the record-buying public to believe that Sousa was conducting himself. Clark also conducted 67 recordings for Victor in 1902 and 3 with his own Clark's Band of Providence. By the time he had assumed directorship of the Anglo-Canadian Band in 1918, concert bands were no longer being recorded in large numbers. Thus, he made no commercial recordings as conductor of this band or the Long Beach Municipal Band, which he conducted for over 20 years. Clark recorded over a dozen sides as first cornetist with the Victor Brass Quartet. Arthur Pryor was first trombonist on this album, or on these sessions. And Clark also made many duet and trio recordings, as Fred played in his session last night. Due to time limitations, and since Clark was and is best known as a cornetist, my paper will focus entirely upon his recordings as a cornet soloist. Before I delve into that, I want to show a few pictures of Clark and his bands. This is the only portrait of Clark in his maturity which does not have a mustache. This is Clark with Victor Herbert's 22nd Regiment Band. Victor Herbert took over the Gilmore Band after Gilmore's death, after David Wallace Reeves had basically lost lots of money being the director. Then the band approached Victor Herbert. He took over the band and led it for about half a dozen years. This is Clark, third from the left of the harp. This is John Philip Sousa's band in Paris in the year 1900. Clark is right there. Clark was always the musician immediately to Sousa's right when he played with Sousa. Part of that was because it made it easier for him to stand up then and play a solo. But Sousa undoubtedly heard no musician better than he heard Herbert L. Clark, and he always sang Clark's praises to the utmost. This 1900 tour of Europe by the Sousa Band was remarkable in several ways. It was their first European tour. They took Europe by storm. One of the reasons was that they played cakewalks and ragtime pieces and basically introduced that type of music to Europe. The band, when they would play at a Georgia camp meeting and Maple Leaf Rag and other pieces such as that, would cause the Parisian audiences to jump up into the aisles and begin dancing. And this apparently inspired Debussy to write Golliwog's Cakewalk and some of his other pieces, because Debussy did hear the Sousa Band here. The other less important musically but more interesting trivial pursuit or whatever is that this band had a baseball team. This band would play other bands, baseball teams, or whoever they could find just as part of their recreation. They played the first game of baseball ever played in Paris or in Europe on July 4th, 1900. They played against the U.S. Marine Exhibition Guards at the Paris Exhibition. Anton Horner, who was first horn with the Philadelphia Orchestra for 43 years, got his start playing in Sousa's band. He was a member of the Sousa band team at that game. He wrote in the Sousa Band Fraternal Society News about that game in the early 50s, and he remarked that a keg of beer was placed at third base. I don't remember who won or lost the game, but a real good time was had by all. This is Clark as he looked in his early years with Sousa. And here's the outside of a program from the Willow Grove Park concerts when Clark was directing Clark's American Band in 1902. This is a blow-up of that program. Notice that he's playing three Clark pieces on the program. He apparently followed the same encore practice that Sousa did and undoubtedly interspersed some of his other marches in there. He would step down after the opening overture to play a cornet solo and probably then an encore during these performances. This is the standard issue Clark portrait. This is one that's in my personal collection I bought at an auction. It's autographed by Clark at the bottom. This is, again, a Willow Grove Park concert program. This is from 1917, September 9th. That was the last day that Clark played with Sousa's band. They were ending their Willow Grove run at that time. And Clark wished to retire at the top of his playing from Sousa. And so 3 days before his 50th birthday, he retired as cornet soloist with Sousa's band. This is his business card from the Anglo-Canadian Leather Company band. This is dated October 15th, 1918. There was a message on the back of this. Here's Clark in his Canadian band uniform. And we're missing his head here, but here's a full-length view, minus head. This is the Canadian Leather Company band at the Toronto exhibition in 1919. They played annually there while Clark was director. Here he is at a Southern California exhibition with the Long Beach Municipal Band. This is the Long Beach Municipal Band in their band shell at the Municipal Auditorium in Long Beach, which is no longer existent. The Pacific Terrace Theater now sits on that site. And this is a typical program that Clark played every week, 50 weeks a year with the Long Beach Band. They were one of the big tourist attractions in the 20s, 30s, and early 40s if you went to Long Beach. They would play on the beach during the summer daily, and they would play in the Municipal Auditorium also. There are occasional appearances by Clark of Clark pieces on these concerts. Here, Clark is obviously enjoying the benefits of being director of such a prestigious band. Here he's examining the majorettes. This was an affair. These majorettes actually had nothing to do with the band. And here are the majorettes examining Clark. As they say in the Army, rank has its privileges. And this is Clark in his later years. When examining the repertoire played and recorded by Clark and his contemporaries, it must be remembered that the soprano brass literature dating back to the early Baroque era, which is so widely recorded today, was totally unknown during this golden age of professional bands. The abandonment of the clarino register by composers and performers during Mozart's time led to an almost total neglect of the voluminous Baroque trumpet repertoire for two centuries before artists such as Scherbaum, Voisin, and others began recording this in the 50s. Early 20th century performances of Bach's Second Brandenburg Concerto often utilized clarinet or even soprano saxophone instead of the trumpet due to the unavailability of high-pitched trumpets and proficient trumpeters suitable for performance of this treacherous part. Haydn's trumpet concerto was totally ignored for over a century after its March 28, 1800 premiere in Vienna. Not until it was published in 1929 in Belgium and recorded in the mid-30s did the Haydn trumpet concerto begin to gain its current popularity. It's currently the most recorded trumpet piece with over 20 recordings listed in the Swan catalog. The Hummel trumpet concerto of 1803, probably the second most popular trumpet concerto nowadays, remained unpublished until 1959. Although valves were invented around 1815, their universal adoption did not occur for at least a generation. The preferred soprano brass instrument among American musicians of the early 19th century was the keyed bugle, of which Ned Kendall was the supreme virtuoso. Patrick Gilmore, it is almost forgotten today, was a cornet virtuoso and was one of the first. He played in a very famous duel with Ned Kendall. Gilmore played cornet, Kendall played keyed bugle, and they both played Holloway's Wood Up Quick Step. And after it was apparent that Gilmore had more technical proficiency than Kendall, the world's greatest keyed bugle player, the cornet then began to replace the keyed bugle as the preferred soprano brass instrument. From that time until the 1940s, American, French, and German cornet solos were composed in large numbers, primarily by touring virtuosos such as Clark. Recordings of cornet solos were common until the 1920s. Other prominent cornet soloists and recording artists during Clark's heyday included Jules Levy, Bulmer Krill, Walter B. Rogers, Alessandro Liberati, and Herman Belstead. With changes in the musical tastes after World War I, cornetists making recordings in the 1920s were such early jazz greats as Louis Armstrong and Bix Beiderbecke. Recordings of turn-of-the-century cornet solos once again became commercially attractive during the mid-70s with the release of three cornet solo albums by Gerard Swartz, two on Nonesuch Records, one on Columbia. Other contemporary artists then began to record this repertoire. Perhaps the best known of all of these recordings nowadays is Wynton Marsalis' album Carnival on CBS Records. This album cover for this is very deceptive because it shows, of course, white musicians and black musicians playing in the same concert band, which never, ever happened at that time. In 1979, Crystal Records, with the support of the International Trumpet Guild, reissued 11 selections as performed by Clark, dating from 1904 to 23, on an album called Herbert L. Clark with the Sousa Band and the Victor Orchestra, Crystal Records Historical Issue S450. My paper is an outgrowth of biographical research I've done on Clark over the past 4 years, and my research on Clark's recordings should be regarded as in progress rather than as definitive. Many of Clark's recordings have been examined by myself at the American Bandmasters Association Research Library at the University of Maryland, the Library of Congress, the Herbert Clark Collection at the Harding Band Building at the University of Illinois, the Glenn Bridges Collection now at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and the Cameron Graham Memorial Band Library of Altoona, Florida, which is a very great repository, virtually unknown to most collectors. Other data was derived from the invaluable discographies of Victor Records by Fagan and Moran, James Smart's discography of the Sousa Band, and many others too numerous to mention. In part four of his autobiographical series, The Road to Success, originally published in Jacob's Band Monthly in 1937 and reprinted many times since, Clark reminisced about his first recordings. He had joined Sousa's band in April 1893 in New York City. For 2 weeks, twice daily rehearsals were held to prepare for the band's upcoming tour. Clark wrote, "In the evening during these 2 weeks of rehearsals, I played a few engagements around New York and also made band arrangements of several vocal numbers for the singers who would accompany us on tour. And on Friday, April 28th, 1893, in New Jersey, I played the first time for the phonograph." Clark does not talk anymore about this. It's unclear as to whether these were solo recordings or with members of Sousa's band or others. None of these cylinders made for the New Jersey Phonograph Company of Newark, then the only company in the state, have survived, so further details regarding Clark's recording debut are unknown. The first recording which featured Clark in a solo role was made in 1898. Clark and trombonist Arthur Pryor played the solo parts in a Columbia Phonograph Company recording of Home to Our Mountains from Verdi's Il Trovatore. Clark's first documented recordings as a cornet soloist were made on June 8, 1899 in New York for the Berliner Company during sessions with Sousa's band. Accompanied by Sousa colleagues, Clark recorded Jules Levy's Flashy the Whirlwind Polka, which was then a cornet repertoire standard, and Sidney J. Perrin's Mammy's Little Pumpkin Colored Coon. Later that year, Clark recorded with piano accompaniment four other works for Berliner, Killarney by Balfe, Victor Herbert's Ah Cupid, J. Oscar Casey's Flocktonian Polka, and Malloy's Love's Old Sweet Song. He made other recordings of each of these works throughout the ensuing decade. Clark produced 18 solo recordings during 1900, more than any other year in his life. In April of that year, he recorded two of his own compositions with Sousa players for Berliner, The Bride of the Waves and My Love for You. The Bride of the Waves was to become Clark's biggest hit. It had been composed only a few months earlier. He recorded it at least a dozen times until 1912 for Berliner, Victor, Monarch, Deluxe, British Phonograph Industries, Odeon, and Edison. This work still remains the most popular Clark composition. The ballad My Love for You is a totally different case. It was originally a collaboration with the famed English lyricist William Gardner. Clark wished to cash in on Gardner's fame, and he did not sell the original version for soprano and piano outright, but on a royalty basis. His first year profits for this work totaled 32 cents in postage stamps. Thereafter, Clark decided to write music for cash. He recast My Love for You for cornet and piano and eventually recorded it three times. Although published in 1904, in the revised format by Lyon and Healy, this ballad never caught on and gained great popularity. This pattern of recording showy pyrotechnical numbers and balancing that with tender ballads remained constant throughout Clark's career and was a reflection of his practice on the concert stage as well. In September, October, and November of 1900, Clark recorded with Sousa colleagues for Improved Records, a firm which later became the Victor Company. Among the works he recorded that fall was Jules Levy's Grand Russian Fantasy, which he recorded on November 9th. This is the earliest recording of Clark's which I have heard, As you listen to this, notice the lightning quick triple tonguing and the lack of breaths in the final variation.
Grand Russian Fantasy, played by Mr. Herbert L. Clark, Cornet Solovich of Cooper's Band.
Notice that the piano player never makes the tempo changes along with Clark. That piece, by the way, is on Wynton Marsalis's album. In 1901, Clark recorded 15 solo sides, all for Victor, with several of these being re-recordings of works done the year before, since the original masters had worn out. Of the works not previously recorded, most were popular songs, such as My Moonlight Lou, My Black Pearl, and perhaps Love's Dream Will Last Forever. With his assumption of the conductorship of the American Band of Providence in 1902, Clark's solo recording slacked off, although he did include a few cornet solos among the recordings he made with that band for Victor. On March 1, 1904, Clark rejoined Sousa as first chair cornetist, principal cornet soloist, assistant conductor, and personnel manager, positions he held until 1917. Clark's salary was more than Sousa had ever paid anyone else. On December 22nd, Clark made the first recordings of his two newest solos, Valse Brilliant, later renamed Sounds from the Hudson, and Rondo Caprice, later renamed From the Shores of the Mighty Pacific. Clark apparently had little imagination in naming his own pieces, and most of the picturesque titles were given to him by Sousa. While on Sousa's tour of Europe in 1905, Clark recorded solos for the Odeon Company of London. Among the works he recorded were his Valse Brilliant and Ethelbert Nevin's The Rosary. These, upon returning to the States, Clark again recorded for Victor and also made four duet sessions with Sousa colleagues on Edison Cylinders. 1906 saw the first recordings of Clark's duet masterpiece, Cousins, which he recorded for both Victor and for Edison, as well as the first recording of his little-known showpiece, La Vita. Basically, that's little-known because no one else can play it except Clark. The proposed Sousa Band World Tour of 1907 fell through, so Clark spent much of that year on his farm in Reading, Massachusetts, and did not enter the recording studios at all. In fact, the only 1907 recording made by Sousa musicians was one side of Army bugle calls. On the other side are more Army bugle calls played by members of Pryor's band. Clark's next solo recording engagement was October 21, 1908, when he again recorded The Bride of the Ways and made the first recording of Caprice Brilliant, now known as The Debutante. With the Victor Orchestra, he recorded his own version of the Carnival of Venice that year on Victor. Listen to the virtuosity and breath control in his final variation. Five breaths for the entire variation, and there must be 5,000 notes on that page. Although Clark's 1909 recording output was not extensive, it included new renditions of most of his most popular compositions. Several of these pressings are reproduced on the Crystal Records album. From 1909 onward, most of Clark's recordings were with orchestra rather than band accompaniment. His only recording of 1910 was again of The Bride of the Waves, this time for Edison. Sousa's band toured the world from December 24, 1910 to December 9, 1911. Clark performed 473 program solos plus encores on this tour. Sometimes he played more than one encore after the solo. Inspired by the hospitality of the Australian people during their stay there, Clark composed one of his most dramatic solos, The Southern Cross, which he recorded twice in May of 1912. He also recorded for the first time on May 18th of 1912, his Showers of Gold, a scherzo for cornet and band or orchestra. After 1912, Clark no longer recorded for Victor. Largo from Handel's Circes, recorded December of that year, was to be his last solo recording for almost 4 years. Even though the Sousa band had signed an exclusive contract with Victor in 1911, they made very few recordings from that time until Sousa's death in 1931. Clark renewed his association with Columbia in 1916 with a recording of his own Neptune's Court, a cornet solo inspired by his many ocean voyages with Sousa. In addition, he again recorded his own version of the Carnival of Venice as well as some ballads. Among the sides recorded in the summer of 1917 was his own waltz, Twilight Dreams. I'm going to play for you now an example to show that Clark was not just a sheer technician, but also had a great melodic sense. This is his recording of Jean-Baptiste Fauré's song, The Palms. This is the type of piece he'd play for an encore. Thank you. rest of the recording is essentially the second verse. 2 months after making that recording, Clark retired from Sousa's band. Although he continued to make occasional solo appearances during his 5-year term as director of the Anglo-Canadian Leather Company band, he had only 2 solo recording sessions during that time. During a visit to New York in November 1922 to visit his brother, who was teaching trombone at Juilliard at that time, he recorded 2 of his own works, The Carnival of Venice again and Stars in the Velvety Sky for Brunswick Records. Repeat performances of these 2 works for Brunswick in 1923 closed out his recording career. I'd like to play an example of Clark in this final recording of Stars in the Velvety Sky, which is his last well-known cornet solo. This recording shows that even several years after having left the glamour of Sousa's band, being basically up in cold, frigid Canada conducting a band most of the time, this guy could still play. This recording, I think, proves that Clark's skills had not slipped at all. Shortly thereafter, Clark moved to California, where on November 30th, 1923, he assumed the position of director of the Long Beach Municipal Band. Although he played occasional solos during his first years there, he found that the pressures of conducting nearly 600 concerts per year did not enable him to perform at the level that he wished to perform at. His only solo performances during the 1930s were impromptu exhibitions at band clinics. According to knowledgeable observers such as William Ravelli, conductor emeritus of the University of Michigan bands, Clifford Lilia, trumpet professor emeritus at the University of Michigan, Clark's musicianship, technique, and tone were still impeccable 2 decades after his retirement from Sousa. Clark's impact upon generations of American brass players cannot be overestimated. In fact, when I want to convince my own private students that they're not as good as they think they are, I play Stars in the Velvety Sky or Carnival of Venice for them. Clark's fame while with Sousa rivaled that of many rock stars of today, as Fred Williams mentioned last night. Clark was idolized by countless musicians around the world who heard him live and on recordings. Alan Britton, former dean of music at the University of Michigan and past president of MENC and the Sonic Society for American Music, told me, "When I was a freshman at the University of Illinois, I was amazed that everyone didn't think that Herbert L. Clark was the greatest musician in the entire world like I did." Even though Clark's last live solo performance was a half century ago, Clark's reputation continues to flourish due to his abundant, awe-inspiring recordings. Let us hope more are reissued. Thank you. Anyone have any questions?
Well, Craig will be here. If any of you have any questions, he will be here to... Oh, you have one question? A quick question, Jerry?
Yeah. Gerald Parker from Montreal. When you mentioned collections that you consulted, you didn't mention the National Library of Canada's collection. They have a very, very large collection of materials on Clark and are very strong in their earliest recordings. If you've never gone there and used the collection for sheet music and recordings and memorabilia and so forth, it would enrich your research considerably.
Thank you. I've been trying to gather travel funds to go to Canada, and I'm hoping to do that. So,
yeah, it's a very strong collection in Clark's materials. Canadians, because of Clark's time in Canada at various points in his life, regard him as one of their own, although I'm sure Americans are not about to give up that that honor.
Right.
When I was growing up, I grew up in Long Beach, California, and that it's true that band had just a phenomenal schedule. They played every day practically in public parks. They toured the schools. I saw the band many times in schools, although by that time Clark had died. But he was often mentioned from the stage in the school auditoriums. You know, this is something that he did, or a work that he played or wrote or whatever. He was very honored, even then, although that I'm speaking of, you know, just a couple of decades or two after he died. So I really enjoyed that presentation, because I've heard about Clark ever since I was a tiny kid.
Well, thank you. Any other questions? If anything pops into your mind, just catch me in the halls sometime tonight. Thank you.
Yeah, Craig will be here for any questions that you may have. And listening to the last two talks, I was thinking that one of the great advantages of this talk, this presentation, is that famous figures, you know, like Fraser or Clark, acquire a more human dimension, because through these people who know them, who present their work, we can see their weaknesses as well as their strong points. So whether it's Fraser, Clark, Toscanini, Edison, or Berliner, we get out of this conference with a much, much better knowledge of these people and the human dimension. So anyway, this concludes now my duties as program chairman of this convention, and all what I can say now.
Have a report.
Oh, okay. Well, yes. I just want to thank you so much to all of you for your wonderful cooperation, and our hosts here, Ted Sheldon, Chuck Haddix, and many of their staff who gave us all these wonderful facilities here. And I will be working very closely with my successor, our next program chairman, Dick Spotswood, and making sure that every experience I have gained here will be of some benefit to Dick. So anyway, basically, this is all I had to say. Thank you very, very much to all of you for a wonderful cooperation. And thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.